This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to the Deceptively Fast podcast. I am really excited about this one today because I'm going to get to speak to an author of a book I just read. I'm at his home in League City, just 12 minutes from my house. I didn't even realize he lived this close to me. But since I was a little kid, I've kind of had, I had an obsession with going to space and being a pilot when I was a little kid. And somewhere along the way, I lost it. I read Clayton Anderson's book, Ordinary Spaceman, and it kind of rekindled a whole lot of stuff. So I reached out to Clayton Anderson, who has a new book coming out. It's A Question of Space and Ordinary Astronauts, Answers to Sometimes Extraordinary Questions. This is a man who, as he was working for NASA, applied 15 times to be an astronaut. Now, that's one time per year. So this was 15 times over 15 years he applied to be an astronaut before he finally became an astronaut, and spent 167 days in space at the International Space Station. Clayton, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Seth. It's an honor to be here with you.
No, it's this is one of my favorite parts of living in Houston and living where I do now, is that I get to drive past the space shuttle. Like routinely.
Sweet.
And I get to drive past the Saturn rocket routinely, and I get excited every single time I do it. You spent 167 days in space. 166 and a half?
Well, let's round up. Astronauts like to round up.
Okay.
Bigger numbers.
Yeah. And it was you and a bunch of Russians and Americans over that time.
Yes.
I kind of gear this podcast so far, it's worked out to that I'm gearing it towards an intellectual meathead variety, and I feel like you're a little bit of an intellectual meathead.
Oh, absolutely. I use small words, I speak slowly.
But you started off as an engineer at NASA, mm-hmm. and in the course of 15 years, you applied 15 times. The one thing that was really impressive to me when I read Ordinary Spaceman was, and this is something that actually reminds me of J.J. Watt, was that you seemed from a very young age to not be bashful at all about telling anybody and everybody that you wanted to be an astronaut. And I think a lot of people lack that. I think a lot of people maybe are afraid to be made fun of or are afraid to put it out there like that. Did your parents instill that in you, or is that just that you were that focused on it?
My mother in particular, was really good about dreams, and she was really good about encouraging you to go wherever you want. Because one of the nice stories I talk about her, I wanted to go to UCLA and play basketball out of high school for John Wooden. And my dad comes in the room, you know, and I'm talking to my mom about sending him my ACT scores and all that. And dad says, UCLA, that's in California, isn't it? Yeah, Dad. California's kind of expensive, isn't it? Yeah, Dad. Well, maybe you shouldn't go to UCLA then. And, you know, then he leaves the room. Like, back then, that's the way some dads were, right? And my mom leans over and she goes, if you want to go to UCLA, we'll find a way. Mm-hmm. We will find a way. And that's all I needed, right? And that's what kids today need, I think, is to realize that they're just like me. You know, if somebody said J.J. Watt is just like me, that's a true statement to a certain level, right? And every kid should have that feeling, and they should understand that. Don't ever tell yourself no. If it's your J.J. Watt, let the coach at Wisconsin or Bill O'Brien at the Texans tell you no, J.J., you can't play quarterback, right? But don't tell yourself you can't play quarterback.
And your mom was kind of the person that took the brakes off of you. They took away that. Well, maybe I shouldn't think about doing this. Maybe I can't do this.
And she did. And the neat thing is, Dad didn't say much, but Dad let my mom and paid for my mom to get her master's degree in speech pathology while my dad slaved away at a piddly job in Nebraska. Because even back then, his actions spoke louder than his words, because at that time, a lot of husbands would not have allowed their wife to succeed them educationally and to succeed them in bread-winning capability and all that. So I just watched, and the way he handled her and let her do that showed me a lot about what you can do.
And then you go off to Hastings College, mm-hmm. which is not a huge college.
It's not? No.
which you know. But again, and you talk about this in your book, you were very forthcoming and open about you wanting to be an astronaut. And it turns a sequence of events which might otherwise seem like chance or fate. It makes a whole lot of sense when you look at the broader context, because one of your professors on an alumni shooting, alumni hunting trip, correct?
Well, yep.
Ended up talking to somebody who worked at NASA.
Right. So the guy that was a Hastings College graduate in 1961 worked at Johnson Space Center in Building 30, actually. And he came up every fall to hunt pheasants in Nebraska. And so he shows up to hunt, and somehow he gets paired with one of the career guidance counselors at Hastings College, and they're stomping through the woods, and they're talking about what they do, and he says, I work at NASA. Oh, we have a kid here at NASA that loves NASA. And, oh, he does? Well, does he know we have an internship program? Oh, no, I don't think so. And, well, would he like to know about you? Well, yeah, I'm thinking he would. Well, I can send him would you, please? And so all that kind of comes together, and then I make the application. Now, I was an athlete in college. I was a pretty good student. I was in student government. You know, I did a lot of things, which was nice that a small school like Hastings could afford me to do that. And that helped my resume such that I got a phone call about being interviewed to get that job. And getting a summer internship and putting your foot through the door is a big step along the way.
Mm-hmm. And so you end up at NASA. You do a great job at your internship. You end up at NASA. And this is where the part, it just is mind-blowing to me, I suppose, is that you applied over the course of 15 years, and you kept at it methodically. Was anybody else like that at the time? Were there other engineers or scientists that were also, like, they were working at NASA and also applying to be astronauts over and over again?
I'm sure there were. At that point in my career, I hadn't really done much, and so it's easy to apply. It's hard to get selected. So filling out the paperwork and doing all that triviality and mailing it off is not a big deal. But I hadn't built a resume yet that allowed me to compare. But I'm sure there were other people just like me at various venues there at JSC or Kennedy Space Center around the country that were trying to become astronauts as well. But I didn't want to follow any formula, right? I just wanted to do the best job I could, apply, try to better myself through the years and see how that would get me.
So you finally are accepted into the program. And there's a few questions I want to ask you along the way. I showed you, I've got like 7 pages of notes from your book. It was, you know, with voice to text, it's easier than it,
right,
than it used to be.
It's I not, understand.
I wasn't necessarily slaving over it. but the space station, there are a lot of questions about that. The part that I never realized or would have thought of is that when you spend 5 months in space and you get back to Earth, all of a sudden it's kind of a shock to your system, feeling gravity for the first time. And the most meatheadish question I could think to ask you about that is, how long did it take you to get your bench back up to what it was before after you landed?
3 weeks.
3 weeks, that's it.
Yeah.
So you go from feeling no gravity at all to then you land, you're barely able to lift your arm, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what's that like over 3 weeks?
Well, I would imagine it's very similar to some of the rehab that JJ and Deshaun Watson and those guys go through after an injury. Because I came home, the very first day I was home, I didn't do anything. But the next morning, I was riding the bike for 15 minutes. And it was on a weekend. So then on Monday morning, I had Sunday off. Monday morning, I came in, and for 3 weeks, I did 2.5 hours of rehab every morning. And I did it religiously. Having been an athlete, I knew what was required, right?
Right.
Some people, when they get injured or whatever, and they're not been in athletics, they, when it starts to hurt, they stop and they go, I can't do this, it hurts. Well, that's part of what you have to push through. Mm-hmm. So I worked hard enough that in 3.5 weeks the doctors cleared me physically, and typically it takes 6 to 8 weeks, and I could bench press what I could before I left. I could run 2 miles in the same time. And
that whole time you're on the space station, you're working out a mm-hmm. lot, right?
2.5 hours a day.
2.5 hours a day mm-hmm. of mostly cardio.
We do resistance training. I'm thinking every day. Yeah. It's hard to remember anymore. But we did aerobics every day too, but we alternated the bicycle with the treadmill with the bicycle with the treadmill.
Okay.
So you had more aerobic forms of activity than you did weightlifting. But now they have a really nice resistance machine that allows them to they're saying that they come back stronger, some of them, than when they left.
Oh, no kidding. So it simulates all the different things that you would do.
Right. Like bench, resistance, squats, all that direction. Stuff. And it uses pistons, hydraulic pistons, to make the resistance. Whereas I had a pulley cable system where, you know, the pulleys would wrap around a cylinder, you know, yeah. and I'd pull against that, and then you could tighten the cylinder down, and so it'd make it harder. But I maxed out that on squats in the first week.
Oh,
so
no kidding.
I had to do, if I was supposed to do 50 two-legged squats, I had to do 100 with each leg. You know, it was,
And then boredom sets in over it because you don't have that much variety.
Well, I watched TV while I did. I watched Hogan's Heroes, Gilligan's Island, and Get Smart. Uh-huh. Episodes that they had sent to me when I worked out, and I also watched the news, the nightly news.
Oh, okay. Well, that can be stress-inducing, though.
Yeah. For me, it was like, I got something in front of my... You know, I could watch a movie, too. When I ran, I watched movies like Harry Potter. I'd never heard of Harry Potter, right?
Oh, yeah.
And we had the first, second, third, and fourth movie. So I started watching those when I ran, and then when I bicycled, I watched my TV programs like... What's it called? SVU and mm-hmm. you know, whatever was big back then.
And then how long is your work day?
Typically your day is 8.5 hours of sleep. So 15.5 hours of other stuff. Of that 15.5 hours of other stuff, we had a 6-hour work window, a block of 6 hours that we had to work on stuff. But eating, exercising, cleaning up, mealtime, and then administration stuff, like looking at emails and that. Yeah. All that's part of that 15.5 hours.
Oh, okay. So the administrative stuff, your work day is longer than that 6.5 hour window. The 6.5 hour right. window is like the actual physical tasks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of, you know, today, Clay, you're going to clean the toilet, and that takes 30 minutes, and then you're going to go do this, and that takes 1.5 hours. And then
yeah.
you're gonna, you know. So they could only schedule us for 6 hours of that sort of stuff. And usually I got done faster, so I had extra time. Some days you'd go a little long. You might work extra just because it was a spacewalk, getting ready for a spacewalk or something. But I never found it debilitating or crazy, right? Usually if I had a tough day one day and worked extra, I had a couple of days where I could get stuff done and relax a little bit.
Well, that's a huge part of it, isn't it? And that's what... I guess over time you streamline that within NASA is figuring out just how much psychological stress there is and how much guys can handle.
Well, you know, in my time...
You're getting a look at that speaks of bureaucracy.
Yeah, you figure it out yourself, right?
Okay.
Before I left, the psych treatment I got was a 30-minute briefing where the guy basically said, hey, you're on your own, you know.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Uh-huh.
And so you get into space and then you learn... or at least I did with my two Russian crewmates, I was able to figure out, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, when I was being really stressed and when I was carrying my stress and anger back to the ground, right? Because I spoke out, right? If I was frustrated or I was mad or I thought something was stupid, I told them. And that doesn't go over well.
Yeah. Well, that part was really interesting to me because you started off as an engineer mm-hmm. and then you become an astronaut. And in a lot of ways, it seems, tell me if I'm wrong here, it seems like in some ways ground control wants the astronauts to be extremely intelligent monkeys, right? Like they want you to just take orders and do right. what they say, right. where you've got that that engineer's mentality too, where you want to tinker with things and fix things. And was it simply a matter of like, oh, all of a sudden now we've got an engineer up there that's talking to us the way we talk to them?
Good question. And I have to give you my perspective, right? Because I've never really sat down with any of the people that supposedly didn't like the fact that I talked back.
Yeah.
My deal was I met with all these people before I flew, and I said, look, don't ever take anything I say personally. I'm trying to make the program better for the 10th guy that comes behind me, right? And I actually took written crew reports from the first 12 expeditions to the space station. And those all had the crew's top 5 complaints, I guess, if you will, or recommendations. And I read them every month. I took the whole thing out, and I read all of them every month. And I saw that some of them had never been addressed. And I was still dealing with stuff that those guys dealt with in the days past, right? And I didn't want that. And so I stepped out of a box and I said, look, do you know that Expedition 4 wrote this in their crew summary briefing back in 2003 or whatever, and we're still jacking with this in an inappropriate way? Mm-hmm. Well, they don't want to hear that part. And to their credit, though, they're hard-driven, hardworking folks, but they're not there. They're not in my house.
Yeah.
And if I go to your house and I tell you to move all the dishes from cabinet A over to cabinet D, and you say, okay, and you move them all, and then 2 days later they say, move those same dishes to cabinet F, and you go, all right. And then you move them to F, and then two more days go by, and they say, hey, would you move them back to A, where they were originally? And you go, what are you guys thinking?
Yeah. Right.
And that's the part I wanted to stop. I wanted that to go away. Because I was a referee in college, you know, basketball, right? And proper planning prevents poor performance.
The 5 P's, 6 P's? Well, yeah, it's 6 P's if you add the extra bodily fluid in there, right? The P poor execution.
Exactly.
Right? There's a book. It's surprising to me, I guess, that might happen at NASA, just because there's a book I read. For the life of me, I can't remember what it's called right now, but it's a former fighter pilot who kind of goes to businesses and he talks to them about using the way fighter pilots plan missions and then also control for things afterwards. And there's the planning portion, there's the execution portion, right. And then immediately afterwards is the debrief.
Right.
And the debrief's the big part where, okay, right, these are the issues. How are we going to fix them next time before the planning? And it's really cool. The Giants actually used it. Mm-hmm. And Eli Manning credits it with him becoming a leader. And then because of Eli, the Broncos started using it. So I guess it surprises me that NASA, who's full of pilots, doesn't necessarily have that same method or structure. Is part of it just that everything is so big?
Yeah. It's a tough road to hoe in that. When an astronaut comes back, the group that's badgering them with the questions during debriefs is a large group, and they only care about their little piece of the big pie. And typically, I found that no matter what the astronaut said, they didn't hear all of it. Mm. And you have to be willing to listen and hear all of it in order to impactfully change your process. And sometimes we get, and I do too, we get in that mode where we only listen to what we're listening for, and we don't hear the other pieces, right? And you take that away, and you think, oh, man, they loved our system. They thought we were awesome. Well, you didn't hear the first part where, you know. And that's part of that cultural bureaucracy and that cultural upbringing that says, we're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to make sure everything is safe all the time. But we have to constantly keep telling each other to listen to one another, right? Because you can go back in the Challenger days and the Columbia days, and there was always somebody that said, hey, we probably shouldn't do this or we should do that, and we didn't listen.
Right.
And look where we ended up.
It was Flawless Execution was the name of the book, and the company is Afterburner. It's a really cool company. I should direct you to somebody because they have speaking opportunities, and you're a very good speaker.
Oh, thank you.
You'd be great with this. They love incorporating different special ops people. Pilots and what have you. So we'll hook you guys up.
I haven't killed anyone.
So I guess the one part too of the book that, and I was really impressed with how frank and open you were with about this, was that they said, they told you, look, okay, this, something's not working out with your interpersonal issues that you're having with crowd control. And you went back and you worked at it. You took seminars, you did all this, and ultimately it just wasn't going to work out. Is now that you've had some time and you're removed from that a little bit, is there anything you think you could have done differently? Or was it that Clayton Anderson is just at some point going to have to speak his mind about some things?
Obviously, I could always do it differently, right? Yeah. I could have used a different tone of voice or different words from orbit. When I came back and they put me on double secret probation, I went off and I tried to improve my lot in life and prove to them that what they were saying wasn't really the real deal. Because if you talk to my first 15-year career at NASA, you'll find everybody that I worked with said I was a pretty damn good team player, I was a good leader, you know, all those things that they claimed that I wasn't simply because I spoke out. Well, at that point in my career, I figured, hey, I'd earned the opportunity to speak out. I'm flying in space right now, and I'm here. But it didn't work out that way. So obviously, I could go back and I could do it differently. I could play the game. I'm not a game player.
Yeah.
I hate that. And the fact that there's a game involved with all this, that you have to keep your, you know, the phrase is keep your head down and keep coloring. And sometimes I looked up from my coloring book.
Yeah.
And when you look up from your coloring book and you see stuff, it's hard for me not to speak out.
Well, and I would imagine too, because you were part of, I forget the term for it, when you're taking care of the families of the astronauts.
Oh, family escort.
Family escort. You were a family escort during the Columbia disaster.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you saw up close and personal exactly mm-hmm. what the real devastation that can occur. And is that, the one part I never thought about that until you described it was just how many people that affects on the ground, not just the families, but I mean, for all of NASA, mm-hmm. that's devastating, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that I was there with the families at probably the worst moment in their lives, and it was right up there in my life too. And I was part of the process, right? We had sat down and smart people had put together a process. This is what we will do in the event of a tragedy, right? Because Challenger had happened. Well, I went through that process and it was still broken. Mm-hmm. And so after it was over and after I talked to a number of the family members, right? Because they came to me and they unload, right? That's part of the deal. I went back to management and I said, hey, I would suggest that we do this, 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 and this, because this is what the family said they needed at the time. And we still didn't change anything, right? So that goes back to the listening part. You have to be willing to listen to the people that are involved and then take their input and look at it seriously and see if you really can make it better.
I would imagine you've got a pretty thick skin too. So maybe you're a referee.
Yeah.
So of
yeah.
course you've got a thick skin. I did a charity softball, or excuse me, a charity flag football game. And luckily I had to leave at the half. We were encouraging the kids, because it was kids coaching, to have fun right. with it and everything.
Right.
I about snapped. And this is a charity powder puff flag football. And I threw one flag, and I, even knowing that it was ridiculous that it was bothering me, I couldn't imagine what it must be like when you're getting it from actually angry and irate fans that are taking it for real. And to them, it's life and death.
Oh, yeah. You just have to. Sometimes I was better at that than others. But
are you still doing high school games?
No, this was my last year this past season. So I've hung up my referee whistle.
Yeah. Your kids went to school here in League City. Your daughter's mm-hmm. still in school in high school at League
right.
City.
She'll be a senior.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend that I played with, Jeff Novak, who grew up in League City. And he said that bring your father to school day or career day at school got really tense because there's so many astronauts that you felt like, oh, man, my dad's an accountant. I got to compete with Clayton Anderson and these guys. Yeah. But you get a lot of the same questions all the time. And I know the mm-hmm. first one you get all the time is, how do you guys go to the bathroom? I'll answer right. for our listeners. There's suction involved.
Exactly.
So there's that. I guess I would ask the question, what happens when you're doing those 2.5 hours of workout with all your sweat? Does it just evaporate?
No, it stays on your arm, right? Because gravity, when you're in the gym at home, right, you're yeah. going to sweat and the drops will drop to the ground.
Yeah.
But in space, they stay on your skin, which can be kind of unnerving a little bit. But then you just take a towel with you wherever you go and you constantly wipe
okay.
that all off. But then you have to hang that towel on the wall later because that sweat's going to be pulled out of that towel by the environmental control system so you can drink it later.
Oh, okay.
So
every little molecule of water is just constantly being recycled.
And now that includes urine. So
oh, really? It didn't before?
No. And when I was
which
up there.
Which is a big waste of water.
Yeah. Till now. I mean, it's still a big waste because even if you look at urine, when you break it down into the water you can drink and the other stuff, there's a lot of the other stuff. And we still haven't figured out a use for that. So
yeah.
it's still trash.
Do they figure out, are you pretty much operating on whatever caloric needs they've decided that you need
yes.
in a given day, and that's it for the entire time? Is it pretty regimented?
It's
regimented.
It's not necessarily regimented in that we had an experiment we were participating in, the Americans did, where you had to document your food intake for every week. But it was kind of a wag. Sometimes you forget what you had on Monday if you're filling it out Friday. And it wasn't one of those things where you could scan your food and then eat it, scan it, eat it, scan it, eat it. That would be way better. Now, they may do that today, but we didn't do that. We had to figure out a way to remember what we had for lunch, breakfast, dinner throughout the days. And then I'm sure they had a calorie count for me, but I didn't care what it was.
Yeah.
I just ate.
Yeah.
And I lost 12 pounds both times. So 152 days in space, I lost 12 pounds. And 15 days in space, I lost 12 pounds. So that tells me that gravity, zero gravity, says Clay, when he gets to space, needs to lose 12 pounds.
And your body just kind of adjusts
for
it. And
he can sustain, you know, after that.
Has your body been permanently altered in some ways, your bone structure?
I sure as hell hope not. Yeah. But I don't know yet, right? I've been really lucky. I didn't have, they're having eyesight issues, some of them, and I never had that. My feet never bothered me when I came back. You know, I was running and lifting in 3.5 weeks.
Yeah. Radiation for some people is an issue.
That I don't know that I'll know until somebody tells me I might have some form of cancer or whatever.
And, yeah.
And knock on wood again, we're hoping that doesn't happen for a long, long time.
I was reading this morning about the induced hibernation that they're thinking about doing for traveling to Mars.
Yeah.
So they knock you out and you hibernate. How long is the trip to Mars?
It'd be, at least based on today's technology for propulsion, it'd be at least 6 to 9 months, depending on, you know, where Mars is when you leave the Earth.
Yeah.
And how close or far apart you are. Yeah. So let's just say 9 for ease of calculation. So 9 months to get there. And if they line up again, such you could come back in 9 months, that's 18, a year and a half, right? And if you're going to go on a vacation for a year and a half,
yeah,
you're probably going to stay at that resort for a while. So I would add in another 6 to 9 months.
Right. It's not like one of those things where you don't want to drive 2 days for a 2-night vacation and then drive
right.
2 days back.
If my dad wanted to go from Miami to Anchorage, Alaska, right, in an RV that you could never get out of,
yeah,
the entire time, yeah, when he gets to Anchorage, Alaska, he's going to say, get out, have some fun. We're staying a while, you know?
Well, you described the Soyuz, which is the Russian vehicle they use, and you described your training while you were in Russia for that. And then my daughter and I were watching this documentary the other night, and they're showing like the actual Soyuz as it's landing. Mm-hmm. You described it really well, but I hadn't quite pictured exactly how compressed and tight that is. I get in an MRI and I have to calm myself down. I'm doing breathing exercises for a full half hour, you know. So I can't imagine what it was like being in that thing where it just looked, you're packed inside this spacesuit, uh-huh, and then you're packed in next to two other people in this, mm-hmm, tiny little capsule, and you're just completely helpless. Are you a person that needs to talk yourself down from any panic at all, or is it just pretty much, oh, here we are?
No, it's a Volkswagen Beetle with a moonroof, right, attached to a telephone booth. This is a Soyuz capsule.
Yeah.
So when you're in your spacesuit with two other adults and you're in the fetal position with your knees at the dashboard sitting in the front seat of that Volkswagen Beetle, you know, it's tight, but most of us have the fear trained out of us. Now, the anxiety part or the claustrophobia part, if you have any of that, you typically don't get too far in the astronaut world.
Yeah.
But you are way too big.
That's my excuse.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
look, I tell my daughter that. I could have been an astronaut, but...
he has the looks for it, but he's just a little big in stature, so...
You know what? I'm glad you mentioned that, just as far as the appearance. I'm glad you mentioned that I'm good looking. It's very important that we get that in this podcast. No, the PR side of NASA, because you go from, and you bring this up, or you at least you allude to it a couple times in the book about how important you think it is for astronauts to get out there and talk to kids. My daughter does not typically like going with me to work. I told her today that I was going to go talk to an astronaut, and she hopped right in the car. So she's giving Clayton a high five right now. One thing that sets you apart from, I'm guessing, a lot of astronauts and a lot of scientists in general is that you are a person of faith. Like you're a religious person. You have been since you were a kid. You sang in the choir and whatnot. And all these astronauts, whether they're agnostic or atheistic or super religious, so many of them talk about having, whether you want to call it a spiritual experience or an awakening when they're in space and you, mm-hmm, see Earth and you just recognize both how tiny and how large it all is. Is there is there an avenue, do you think, where you could maybe open people's eyes about the space program through your faith, and maybe in a way that a lot of other astronauts don't or can't?
I'm trying to find that on the speaking circuit. You know, there's the agency I have that kind of represents me has been looking into this, because I think it'd be fun to share my experiences about faith. Because when astronauts go, many of them have faith as well, but NASA doesn't really want you to, when you're an active astronaut, they don't really like you to go down that path.
Yeah.
And so,
and it's a government agency,
sure.
So you have, I mean, you have to,
right. So they look, a lot of astronauts like to use the phrase the orbital perspective. Mm-hmm. When I went to orbit, I got a different perspective on the Earth, and I agree totally. I want people to go travel in space for a few days and go to a third world country for a few days, because I think that would change their perspective on life in general on the planet, and I think our relationships could get better worldwide.
It's hard to get perspective on things when you're stuck on social media,
right,
or watching cable news,
exactly,
all day long,
exactly,
and you see the most extreme examples of everything.
Exactly.
Ivan, you know what? I'm blown away every time I have a conversation with somebody in actual real life about just how rational. For all the irrational people there are in the world,
yeah,
that when you sit down with somebody that you don't share the same view on, if it's just you two in a room,
right,
it's amazing how civil a conversation you can have.
Well, that's because the bell curve, right, is, you know, we're always talking to most of the people in the middle of the bell curve, whereas social media and the news is always each far end of that bell curve.
You're seeing,
right,
the extreme.
Oh, I, yeah, and now with social media, that extreme voice is getting way louder than it ever was before. And, you know, and that's why I want to go back. And if we do that speaking thing, I want to speak about my faith. When I saw everything, I get that the Earth is fragile. I get that we need to protect it. I'm going to do my small part. I'm going to recycle. I'm going to mulch my grass when I mow so that it goes back into the yard. I'm going to do whatever I can. I'm not going to drive an electric car necessarily, because plugging it into the wall at night's getting power typically from a fossil fuel-fired power plant. So, you know, there's pros and cons with all this stuff. But what I want people to know is that when I looked out into space, all I could think of was, this ain't random.
Mm-hmm.
This is not random in any way, shape, or form. We're the only species that we know of on a spaceship called Earth that's traveling through the universe. And there may be other species out there traveling on their little spaceship planets in the universe, but it's so large, we just don't know. But the fact that we are the only species right now, and somebody like Stephen Hawking says, we got to get off the planet, we got to go to Mars. Well, do we really? Because maybe we will go extinct. I don't know. I'm not smart enough for that. But if I go to Mars, I got to either build Earth when I get there,
yeah,
or I got to take Earth with me. That's a huge proposition right there.
Well, you know, and whether we do or don't go extinct, it's just a matter of timing. Like, okay,
right,
at some point, the sun's gonna explode or collapse.
What's it do first?
It explodes. Yeah, at some point. My daughter knows this. She's breaking down, crying now. Louis C.K., who's probably not the best guy to quote anymore, he had a bit about how, at one point, he was explaining what would happen to various stars at some point. He was thinking, he was talking about science, and then he realized as he looked at her face that she was just learning that at some point, everybody she knew and everything she saw would someday be completely gone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's something to spring on a kid.
Yeah.
So this new book, It's a Question of Space. This is geared mostly towards middle school and high school kids.
It's targeted for young adults, but it's going to be great for adults as well. And it might be a lot of fun for teachers to have it on their desk at their school, especially if they're science and math type teachers. Every question I got was from social media on Quora.com, which means the questions came from around the world.
Yeah.
The answers, or the questions that I selected to answer, are those where I had a dog in the hunt. I was not going to go out and research a bunch to answer a question. I would look for questions where I could say, oh, well, shoot, I lived in space, and that was a big deal for us. So let me write about what happened to me. And that way I can give humor, and they're not very technical answers. They're hopefully fun to read, and people get a little insight as to what it's like to live and work in space. So that's the target.
You were telling us before we started recording about what it was like to learn how to write, and you had a writer that helped you out along the way. I think, and I know that it's painful to learn how to write for a mass audience, and you did a great job of it in Ordinary Spaceman. And I think the one thing that I really appreciated was you don't just take us from A to B. It's you do that thing that good books do, which is I felt what you were feeling when you went from A to B, mm-hmm. and you could tell me what you were experiencing and thinking as you went from A to B. And a lot of there's a lot of otherwise mundane things, I think, that you breathed a lot of good life into, which there as much as in the Ordinary Spaceman was a perfect description of it, because you're working for the government. And you're not making an exorbitant salary as you're an astronaut, yet you're doing these incredible things. And I suppose for your family sitting back here on Earth when you're gone for 5 months. And what's it like to be stuck on Earth but able to look up and see your dad fly by really fast every now and then?
Well, thank you for your kind words, first of all. I think my kids were 10. Cole was 10 and Sutton was 6 when I was in space the first time. Sutton was pretty excited about everything associated with that because she was kind of famous, right? Because she TV people wanted to talk, or she'd be in, you know, the greatness of media. Yeah. Cole was a little less so. He kind of stayed to the back. Cole's always the kind of kid that didn't want to be known for what his dad did. He wanted to be known for what he did, and I totally get that. So when they would go out, my wife Susan would take him out and watch me pass over. For them, I'm pretty sure it was a cool experience, and just as it was for me to fly over them, and when I knew I was flying over them and I could maybe call her on the phone and stuff, that was pretty surreal, right? That from 250 miles up, I was communicating or at least thinking of that point on Earth where that I was flying over.
I told you I was only going to keep you for a half hour. It's like 36 minutes now, so I'm going to let you go. It's a question of space, an ordinary astronaut's answers to sometimes extraordinary questions. Clayton signed a copy for my daughter. I promised you that wasn't my intent to come over and get a free gift for my daughter. She was excited to see you. But there are some really, you've gotten, for the intellectual meathead, chapter 5 is space physiology and psychology. And Clayton's a really interesting dude. Check it out. Ordinary Spaceman was your book for adults. You have a book for young kids.
Children's called A is for Astronaut.
And now this one, which you could pre-order on Amazon or anywhere else you get books, it's a question of space. Just go ahead and Google Clayton Anderson. Whole bunch of great stuff. Thank you, Clayton.
My pleasure, Seth. It's an honor to be here, and let's do it again.
Yeah, we'll see you before a Texans game.
All right.
Sometime soon.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that's Seth Payne. Hey!
Thanks, man.
You bet.
Football fans, the NFL draft is almost here, and the Free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. AUDACY. Download it today.